dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 660 of Unwelcome Guests, Countering Intelligence, Part 3. I'm Robin Upton, and as the name suggests, we continue this week with the next part of Scott Noble's film Counterintelligence, entitled Necrophilus, that's literally death-loving, and to explain that, it begins with a quote from a Necrophilus character by Eric Fromm. The passionate attraction to all that is dead, decayed, putrid, sickly. It is the passion to transform that which is alive into something unalive, to destroy for the sake of destruction. The exclusive interest in all that is purely mechanical. It is the passion to tear apart living structures.
They called it Trinity. On the morning of July 16th, 1945, in a remote desert near Los Alamos, New Mexico, the atomic age is born. Some scientists weep openly. Others are triumphant. Secretary of War Henry Stimson receives a cryptic message. It reads, "Child is born. Its cries could be heard at my farm, and the light in his eyes seen at yours." The atomic bomb is the culmination of the Manhattan Project, one of the largest, most secretive, and most expensive undertakings by any government in history. Employing more than 200,000 people, it was formed by some of the greatest scientists of the age.
Robert Oppenheimer.
I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
3 weeks later, a squadron of bombers leaves for Hiroshima. Upon departure, a pilot named Major Sweeney describes seeing the most beautiful sunrise he has ever witnessed, a great big red ball of fire coming out of the ocean to the east. He would later describe the atomic bomb in similar terms. It looked like a boiling up with every color of the rainbow. As dark clouds formed overhead, sticky black rain began to fall. It was later understood that the rain itself was radioactive. 3 days after Hiroshima, another atomic bomb was dropped, this on Nagasaki, by Major Sweeney himself.
At 10:58 the morning of August 9th, the bomb was exploded above the city, and in the towering mushroom, Japan could read its doom. This was more than a routine bombing. It was the funeral pyre of an aggressor nation.
Now back to This Is Your Life, Reverend Kiyoshi Tanimoto, and Hiroshima, August 6, 1945. Time is standing still as our Earth shakes to an explosion never before equaled. Now, you've never met him, have never seen him, but he's here tonight to clasp your hand in friendship. Captain Robert Lewis, United States Air Force, who along with Paul Tibbets piloted the plane from which the first atomic power was dropped over Hiroshima. Captain Lewis, come in here close, and would you tell us, sir, of your experience on August 6, 1945?
As I said before, Mr. Edwards, I wrote down later. My God, what have we done?
For many around the world, the attacks were more than justified. They were comeuppance for the brutal atrocities committed by Imperial Japan throughout Asia. Yet as in Japan's own wars, civilians were forced to pay the largest price. In America, the iconography of the new weapon would take on bizarre and ghoulish proportions. Admiral Spike Blandy and his wife celebrated the detonation of a thermonuclear device at Bikini Atoll with an atomic bomb cake. A high school in Richland, Washington, adopted the A-bomb as their official mascot. Church artists carved images of the Enola Gay and other World War II bombers in stained glass windows. If the euphoria has faded over time, the rationale remains the same. The nuclear option was the lesser evil. Though the attacks killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, the alternative was far worse. A ground invasion would have taken millions of lives, both Japanese and American. This view is no longer tenable. The United States' own Strategic Bombing Survey of 1946 states unequivocally that Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, even if Russia had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned or contemplated. The National Archives in Washington chart Japanese peace overtures from as early as 1943. In a cable sent on May 5, 1945, by the German ambassador in Tokyo, and intercepted by the U.S., reveals that the Japanese were desperate to sue for peace, including capitulation, even if the terms were hard.
Secretary of War Stimson.
They're going to destroy Japan's armies, Japan's navy, Japan's air forces, Japan's war factories, Japan's whole power to wage war.
Far from being frightened of Japanese belligerents, U.S. Secretary of War Henry Stimson told President Truman, he was fearful the Japanese would surrender before the new weapon could show its strength. In his diary, he frankly explained a different reason for the assault. The bombs were dropped, in Stimson's words, to persuade Russia to play ball. Together, Hiroshima and Nagasaki constitute not only the most violent act of warfare in history, but also the most violent example of the psychological operation.
And there's a quote from the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations defining terrorism as, quote, the unlawful use of force and violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civil population, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objectives, unquote. This is explained by John Judge from the Coalition on Political Assassinations.
Terrorism, in the broadest definition, is any act that targets civilians rather than military, although some terrorist acts do target military, but generally it's conceded to be targeting of civilians and noncombatants with the purpose of defeating a society. And there's a great deal of state violence against people that they are considered enemies of the state that could be considered and should be considered terrorism. However, the states define terrorism as acts of either asymmetrical warfare where a less armed and capable group is trying to have some influence, might even be self-defensive, and using terrorist tactics in order to dissuade. I mean, I think the human community avoids violence as much as possible. Because of our memory of violence. And when you choose violence, you're not only harming the person you're choosing as the enemy, you're harming yourself. And I think the human community knows that lesson. So people will put up with a great deal of abuse before they go to violence. So many things are called terrorism, and many terrorist acts are exempted. However, if people get to a point of despair or hopelessness, and they feel that there's no other way out and all other options have been tried, then a small segment of them will win by arguing for violence, and for a period they'll get sanctuary and sanction and support out of the larger group for the violence. But once you restore justice and restore hope, then those people are no longer given that sanction and support. And that's really the only way out of the cycle. To respond to terrorism with counterterrorism and violence in the end only creates more victims and more anger.
Graham McQueen from the Center for Peace Studies.
So terrorism is one of these concepts, one of these terms that's obviously very important at the moment to elites in the West. With the Cold War being over, it's pretty much consensus that this is going to be the thing that's going to replace it, the war on terror, global war on terror, blah, blah, blah. And so you have to define terrorism, obviously, very carefully. It has to be something that only they do, and that we don't do, and that takes some pretty fancy footwork. The way the term is generally used is something like shock and awe. When it's carried out by non-state, low-tech groups. So, in other words, elites in the West would prefer that terrorism be something done generally by non-state groups, though it can be backed by terror states, can be backed by enemy states. But generally, they want to avoid the idea of terrorism being attached to states. Even in the axis of evil, I think as a whole, they would prefer that these evil states sponsor terrorism. The notion that states can inherently be terroristic and use terroristic methods is kind of dangerous, because then it might come back to haunt us. So generally non-state, generally low-tech. You know, and blowing yourself up in the marketplace and so on is pretty low-tech too. I said it was a form of shock and awe. What I meant by that is that when we use the word terrorism, we generally refer to an act of extreme violence, which is meant to shock. It's not as if it shocks accidentally. It's meant to shock. It's meant to create awe and, of course, fear, terror, extreme fear, and therefore to intimidate populations.
The bombers took off from the Hornet in the early morning of the 18th of April, 1942. They were about to fly into history. But first, they set course for the Japanese mainland. The bombing of Tokyo dealt a huge psychological blow to the Japanese. And the man who had masterminded and led the raid was the then Colonel Jimmy Doolittle.
In 1954, World War II General Jimmy Doolittle sent a secret report to President Eisenhower. Speaking of the Cold War, he stated, "Hitherto acceptable norms of human conduct do not apply. If the United States is to survive, long-standing American concepts of fair play must be reconsidered. It may become necessary that the American people be made acquainted with, understand, and support this fundamentally repugnant philosophy. It would not be until the Vietnam War that the American people would become acquainted with the repugnant philosophy being promoted behind the scenes. In the immediate post-World War II era, most of the public would be shielded from the carnage committed in their name by a compliant and compromised news media. Yet hidden behind the facade of consumerism and nuclear family values was a relentless struggle over the issues of race, sex, and class. It would not only erupt in the homeland, but on a global scale, leading to the deaths of millions of people at the hands of an increasingly powerful and increasingly paranoid security apparatus.
In Latin America, there are various regimes which at the moment are abusing human rights, political murder, torture, deportations, imprisonment without trial, using the techniques they may have learned in this establishment.
You may be right. If you can say that the skills which we've taught here have been applied, I can't deny that.
Throughout the Cold War, the School of the Americas functioned as the primary training ground for the teaching of terrorism. Based in Fort Benning, Georgia, The SOA, which is now known as WINSEC, has trained more than 60,000 Latin American soldiers and policemen since its inception in 1946. Among its graduates are notorious dictators Manuel Noriega of Panama, Leopoldo Galtieri of Argentina, and Hugo Banzer Suarez of Bolivia.
William Bloom, author of Killing Hope.
It has a new name, but it's still known as the School of the Americas. There are numerous graduates of the School of the America, numerous, who have been involved in many of the worst acts of terrorism in the Western Hemisphere in the past 50 years or so. Classes on bomb making are called How to Defuse a Bomb. And it's the same with torture and assassination. You have to know how to assassinate to avoid of being assassinated yourself. Those are the covers.
From the film The Shock Doctrine, we hear Major Joseph Blair, former teacher in the School of the Americas from 1986 to 89.
Torture techniques taught, from rape to derobing to torture with pointed objects, breaking of extremities, poking eyes out, branding.
Roy Bourgeois, founder of the human rights group School of the Americas Watch.
Most of the courses come around, revolve around what they call counterinsurgency warfare. Who are the insurgents? We have to ask that question. They are the poor. They are the people in Latin America who call for reform. They are the landless peasants who are hungry. They are healthcare workers, human rights advocates, labor organizers. They become the insurgents. They are seen as el enemigo, the enemy. And they are those who become the targets of those who learn their lessons at the School of the Americas.
A lesser-known training facility for both foreign and domestic military and intelligence personnel is Harvey Point. Described in official reports as an annex to the CIA training base at Camp Peary, Virginia. First used to train anti-Castro Cubans for the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1960, the New York Times later reported that Harvey Point has trained 18,000 foreign intelligence operatives from 50 different countries. Among the individuals trained at the facility have been El Salvador's death squad chief, Roberto Dobison, Egypt's General Intelligence Directorate, Colombian counterinsurgency personnel, and Arab cadres who would later join Osama bin Laden's forces fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. According to former CIA officer Robert Baer, whose story was depicted in the Hollywood film Syriana, the 2 weeks of training at Point Harvey was, for all purposes, an advanced terrorism course. Among the techniques taught to new recruits is how to successfully install and remotely detonate a car bomb. Just north of the training facility is that of the mercenary group Blackwater, now known as Academi.
There's a quote from the 1975 book Inside the Company CIA Diary, which explains the meaning of counterinsurgency. Quote, "What counterinsurgency really comes down to is the protection of the capitalists back in America, their property and their privileges." Unquote.
These are children's drawings from El Salvador in the 1980s. The drawings are disturbingly similar to those of Palestinian children in the Israeli-occupied territories. In 2005, a number of media reports suggested that the Pentagon was debating the Salvador option for Iraq. According to the New York Times Magazine, the template for Iraq today is El Salvador, where a right-wing government backed by the United States fought a leftist insurgency in a 12-year war beginning in 1980. The cost was high. More than 70,000 people were killed, most of them civilians, in a country with a population of just 6 million. Most of the killing and torturing was done by the army and the right-wing death squads affiliated with it. Whole villages were targeted by the armed forces and their inhabitants massacred. As part of President Reagan's policy of supporting anti-communist forces, hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. aid was funneled to the Salvadorian army. and a team of 55 Special Forces advisors, led for several years by Jim Steele, trained frontline battalions that were accused of significant human rights abuses. Using the doctrine of plausible deniability, few Americans were directly involved in the actual killing of Salvadorian civilians. This was not the case, however, in Vietnam.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
Operation Phoenix. This was a brainchild of William Colby, who was at that time a senior CIA official in the U.S.-occupied region of South Vietnam, later became director of the CIA. What they would do is the CIA would go out and use their contacts in various Vietnamese regions and say, okay, who are the Viet Cong, which are, Viet Cong is a derogatory term of that era. Who are the Viet Cong in your neighborhood? And here, let me fill in this form of what you have to say. The forms go back to a data center. The data gets entered into the primitive computers as they existed in 1968, 69, 1970. This is way before PCs. Get cranked through the computer. And out comes a list of people's names and their cousins' names, their wives' names, the kids' names. Well, is the kid over here in some other region that where he's getting turned in by somebody else? Bingo. Well, so the father and the kid, two regions, both getting turned in as alleged Viet Cong. Now what do? Well, we do two things. Sometimes they go and capture them and try to turn them into double agents. More often what they did is go and try to identify them and kill them. And by the agency's own accounting, at least 20,000 people were killed in this fashion.
A wide-eyed, PTSD'd Vietnam vet recounts his experience, possibly in a Winter Soldier-like event.
And it got to be where it was like someone would say, okay, you know, you come stay on my farm and you can go hunting every day for free and I'll give you all the ammo you want. And you can hunt and there's no limit and you can go out together and just hunt, you know, and this it was like a hunting trip. And the more people we killed, the happier our officers were, you know. It got to be like a game, like the object was to see who could kill the most people. And the different ways you could prove how many people you killed would be like cutting off ears. Now, if you brought back someone's ears, you know, pretty likely you had to kill them to get them. And then people would, you know, whoever had the most ears, they would get the most beers, and you'd trade your ears for beers.
That's a style of warfare that has, in new forms, been picked up in Central America, the U.S. intervention in Nicaragua and El Salvador. In Nicaragua, it wasn't a direct intervention. They didn't send in the Marines. What they did is they hired a proxy force called the Contras. In El Salvador, again, they didn't send in the Marines. What they did was sponsor a political faction in that country's government and in that country's military. Equip them with these tools. Basically the same framework of collecting rumors about people, compiling the rumors, cross-referencing the rumors, and then using that to support death squads. Today, you got the same situation in Afghanistan. You got the same situation, was a major part of this so-called surge in Iraq.
There's shots of dead people, bodies in Iraq, and a quote from Mutahana Harad Al-Ghani from the Iraqi Association of Muslim Scholars, quote, "They're called the men in black. Nobody dares identify them, although everybody knows who they are." Unquote.
In Latin America, the victims became known as desaparecidos.
Marcia Esparza from the Historical Memory Project.
The first desaparecidos, which means people who disappeared that had been documented, began in Guatemala, the 1950s, whereby the state mobilized its resources to kidnap people, usually the middle of the day, in the streets, in schools, workplace, who were believed to have communist or socialist ideology, or just to sympathize with, you know, organizations who were perceived to be communist.
Millions of people, mostly peasants, were killed by American proxy forces in Latin America during the Cold War. And we hear a short section of the classic speech by John Stockwell on the CIA, which we adapted to produce episode 656.
And I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory, beyond comprehension almost.
Played a key role in helping other governments pick their police intelligence agencies, including, we've learned, the Korean CIA, Uruguayan National Police. Can you tell us about this?
No.
If he appeared in a Hollywood thriller, he would be called a serial killer with sadistic personality disorder. As it happened, he worked for the State Department. Dan Mitrione has become the poster child for American torture during the Cold War. Head of the Orwellian named Office of Public Safety in Montevideo, Uruguay. He was so enthusiastic about torture that he gave live demonstrations. His MO was to kidnap homeless people off the streets and demonstrate torture techniques to a rapt audience of military officials. Reportedly, four homeless men died as a result of Mitrione's demonstrations. Former Uruguayan Chief of Police Intelligence Alejandro Otero explained that Mitrione had instituted torture as a matter of routine. Among Mitrione's recommendations were the adoption of new psychological techniques, such as playing a tape in the next room of women and children screaming, while informing the prisoner that the voices belonged to those of his family. In some cases, no recording was necessary. An investigation by the Uruguayan Senate concluded that during the U.S.-backed Reign of Terror, pregnant women were subjected to various brutalities and inhumane treatment, while certain women were imprisoned with their very young infants and subjected to the same treatment. Similar patterns emerged across the globe. In Guatemala, a Roman Catholic nun named Diana Ortez was raped and tortured in the presence of an American consultant.
For 24 hours, she was tortured and gang-raped. During her ordeal, she identified the leader of the gang as a fellow citizen of the United States.
I came out a totally different person. Yeah. But also with new eyes and more attuned to the hurting the brokenness, the oppression, the deceit of my government. I've heard people say that what happened in Abu Ghraib is an isolated incident. And I have to just shake my head and say, you know, are we on the same planet? You know, aren't you aware of our history? You know, isn't history taught in the classroom about, you know, the role of the U.S. government in human rights violations?
Just as they had done with the tactic of assassination, the CIA was good enough to provide a manual for their proxy forces on the use of torture. Widely known as KUBARK, the title is actually a Cold War cryptonym for the CIA itself. One passage states, "Deprivation of stimuli induces regression by depriving the subject's mind of contact with an outer world, and thus forcing it in upon itself. As the interrogate slips back from maturity toward a more infantile state, his learned or structured personality traits fall away." Dan Mitrione was eventually kidnapped and killed by rebel forces. Incredibly, he was not tortured in turn. After his death, Mitrione was declared an American hero. A benefit for his wife included performances by Frank Sinatra and Jerry Lewis. Decades later, the television show 24 would immortalize one of Mitrione's innovations, pretending that a man's loved ones are being tortured in an adjacent room.
I know everything that you've done. Where is the bomb?
Those men will kill your family if you don't tell me where the bomb is now.
Once again, the torturer would be cast as a hero, but in this case, no cover-up of his activities was necessary. Jack Bauer was a hero precisely because he was willing to engage in the most despicable act of which a human being is capable. In 2012, the propaganda of torture would reach its peak.
I'm not your friend. I'm not going to help you. I'm going to break you. Any questions?
Zero Dark Thirty, a collaborative project between the CIA and Academy Award-winning filmmaker Catherine Bigelow, falsely indicated that torture had been responsible for locating Osama bin Laden. Upon its release, even acting CIA director Michael Morell was forced to admit that the film creates the strong impression that the enhanced interrogation techniques that were part of our former detention and interrogation program were the key to finding bin Laden. That impression is false.
Ray McGovern, former CIA officer.
Torture is something that I never thought that I would be very much interested in or involved in. It's strange credulity that we should be discussing whether torture should be allowed or encouraged by our government. About 6-7 years ago, a radio producer called me up and said, "Mr. McGovern, we're going to have a little colloquium on torture, 20 minutes, 10 for you, we know where you stand on torture, and 10 for one of the advocates of torture, for the other side." And I said, "For the other side?" He said, "Oh yeah, somebody thinks that torture is, you know." I said, "There's another side." Well, I wanted to say, "Well, bring them on, you know," but that's already been used. I don't want to use that. So when I got off the phone, I said to myself, "Ray, I guess, you know, get over your shock, man. Some people really think it's okay. So take 10 minutes out. He's going to call back in 10 minutes. Figure out what you're going to say about torture. It gives the country a bad name. It endangers our own troops. It brutalizes people. And, you know, all you need to do, it brutalizes people. You know, all you need to do is talk to people coming back from Abu Ghraib, as I have. And you'll see that not only were those tortured, brutalized, but the people who were ordered or permitted or encouraged to do the torture were also brutalized. Doesn't work. You know? Torture doesn't work. And what was really, really telling was that when George Bush decided to make his big speech on September 6, 2006, advertising the merits of what he called an alternative set of procedures, read harsh interrogation techniques, okay? On that very day, the head of Army Intelligence, General John Kimmins, decided he'd have his own press conference in the Pentagon. And he released what was the new Army manual on torture, okay? You know what he said? This is a direct quote. No good intelligence has ever come from harsh interrogation techniques. History has proved this, and the empirical experience of the last 5 years, comma, hard years, comma, have also proved this, end quote.
If torture does not produce reliable intelligence, as all credible experts insist, the question remains as to why governments bother to use the tactic at all. One possible answer is that torture is a highly effective method of eliciting fake confessions that serve to justify state policy. Omar Suleiman, who served as Egypt's torturer-in-chief for U.S. rendition programs, managed to extract a confession by Ibn Sheikh al-Libi that Iraq was linked to al-Qaeda operatives and that they were training in the deployment of chemical and biological weapons.
And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons.
No question, we have said that Saddam Hussein possesses biological and chemical weapons.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad.
Later, a child soldier named Omar Kadir, originally hailing from Canada, would be convicted by so-called evidence obtained through torture.
And the film includes footage from the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. I'll give you a quick sample of the sound so you can understand why I'm not including it in this radio adaptation.
Sorry, I have to say what you said.
It makes you wonder, do they not have any proper microphones? Their audio hardware is even worse than mine. Unless, of course, it was designed to prevent its inclusion on programs such as this. The video quality is also pretty rotten. It makes me wonder why they released the footage at all. Did they perhaps do it because they had a legal obligation to do it? Summary is, he says, everything that I said to the Americans was not right. I just said that because they tortured me very badly in Bagram, so I had to say what I said.
The events have a disturbing historical parallel. The show Trials of the Soviet Union portrayed hapless former party officials admitting to counter-revolutionary activities. Confessions obtained through torture.
Slansky was charged with Titoism, spying, and sabotage. His confession was fiction, drafted by Soviet advisers.
A former party official stands at the dock with his head bowed. Even at the beginning, when confronted with bourgeois power, you behaved as an opportunist and a coward, not as a communist. Yes. What a chain of shocking crimes. But despite their conspiracy sabotage and their foul means, they were smashed.
Another answer to the question of why torture is practiced is that it is itself a form of terrorism.
There have been societies in the past, of course, and still some today, which practice torture regularly and don't particularly hide it. It's just part of how the state carries out its functions. And there are also non-state societies that have used it. And it has various purposes. One of them is to intimidate, usually, and to give the message to people, this is who we are, this is what we can do here. And the narrative of freedom, you know, the U.S. not only treasures freedom for its own people, but is also the liberator of other people. So it goes to Afghanistan to liberate Afghan women and the population in general from repressive, autocratic fundamentalists. Right? And it goes to Iraq because this tyrant is there and so on. So this is a liberation narrative. It's a narrative of benevolence. And it's very dangerous, therefore, to have too much of this overt massacre and torture happening. And yet there's always been, along with this liberator narrative, a kind of secondary narrative just a little bit in the wings. A little bit repressed, but very much there. And that's the old one that war makers insist on. It's part of their power. And it is the same one that I mentioned before. This is who we are, and this is what we can do to you. What I see happening now is a shift. I see that the narrative that was in the background somewhat before is now moving to the foreground. So yeah, we knew they were training torturers, the School of the Americas, and that the U.S. was implicated in all this stuff, but they were always trying to say, no, we're one step removed. These guys are out of control. You know, we wouldn't directly get our American hands dirty. We don't do the wet work. I think it's an important shift, and I think it shows the cracks that are developing in the Imperium here, that we don't have legitimate institutions, we don't have the love and affection, the trust, we don't have the credibility, we don't have any of those things that most governments aspire to have. Therefore, we must rule through naked aggression and by inducing fear in you. And that is what the U.S. is starting to resort to. Now, that's very tricky, because it's pretty well known that that these acts of, for example, torture, when you torture people, when you drop bombs on them, when you do shock and awe on them, and even this is even recognized, by the way, in shock and awe documents, military documents, they recognize this. You can induce obedience and awe and fear and so on, but you can also induce resistance, disgust, revulsion, anger, and uprising. And this is the danger you always take. This is the danger that all tyrants court when they try and rule through naked fear. It's very fragile. The power is very fragile.
As it turns out, World War II General Jimmy Doolittle's memo to President Eisenhower, claiming that the U.S. would have to abandon traditional American notions of fair play, was based more on myth than reality. Notably absent from most mainstream histories of the United States, though not military manuals, is the concept of total war. According to this strategy, attacks against civilians and their infrastructure are not only fair game, they are a vital component of the war effort as a whole. In the United States, total war was employed against indigenous populations, with genocidal results. Similar techniques would also be adopted against Filipinos in the late 19th century. During the 20th century, new technologies would permit a new and monstrous efficiency in the targeting of civilians.
After 5 years of killing, the gears of the Vietnam death machine were grinding more slowly in the months before the invasion of Cambodia.
Almost all restraint is off. For the first time, the Vietnamese are seeing the holocaust of conventional war, the kind that leveled much of Korea and destroyed dozens of cities in World War II.
Women, children, babies. Some are dead, some are not dead. By evening, government spokesmen are saying another grand victory has been won in Quang Tri province. The situation is once again stabilized. But there will be more fighting and more words. Words spoken by generals, journalists, politicians. But here on Route 1, it's difficult to imagine what those words can be. There's nothing left to say about this war. There's just nothing left to say. Bob Simon, CBS News, Route 1.
In the wake of Vietnam, American policy planners were faced with a problem. It was called the Vietnam Syndrome and related to a widespread disgust by American citizens over the mass slaughter committed in their name.
James Petrus, Professor Emeritus from Binghamton University.
Now, the problem for Reagan was twofold. We had just come out of the Vietnam War, and public opinion in the United States was overwhelmingly opposed to U.S. military interventions abroad, mainly because of the high loss of lives and the hundreds of thousands of wounded American soldiers and the traumatic experiences they had. What some commentators call the Vietnam Syndrome, that Washington should refrain from military operations outside of the territorial U.S.
In order to reverse the Vietnam syndrome, a new model developed. It involved an economic rather than overt conscription program, as well as intense media censorship of the casualties of war. The public would be taught that modern warfare was a clinical exercise, mostly devoid of civilian casualties, even as the opposite became true.
There's a graph showing estimated percentage of civilian casualties. In World War I, it's around 10. World War II, nearly 50. In Vietnam, 70. Invasion of Iraq, an estimated 90% of casualties are civilians.
Much of the misperception regarding civilian casualties owes to highly deceptive reportage by the media.
Peter Phillips from Project Censored.
What we really have is a military-industrial media complex in the United States. And to say that is that there's been a concentration of media. When Project Censored started 32 years ago, there were 50 major media corporations in the United States, actually a little bit more, probably closer to 60. And in that time, we've come down now to 10 major companies. You know, you've got the big television companies with the 24-hour news, MSNBC and Fox and CNN. And that's where most people are getting their news. So that's very limited. And then you've got the New York Times, Washington Post, you know, LA Times, Chicago Tribune are the big papers. It's very concentrated and very narrow. We have 10 major companies now that dominate the news in the United States and are the suppliers of the ideas and the understandings that the American people have access to. The board of directors of the 10 big media groups could fit in a medium-sized classroom. We're only talking about 120 people or so. And they all pretty much know each other. They, in turn, sit on the boards of directors of like 20% of the corporate 1,000. So they're on big corporation boards in addition to being on media boards. And what we've seen since 9/11 is a real penetration of from the military-industrial companies, the military companies, the top 10, on the boards of directors of media firms. You've got this really in-depth penetration between the military companies, the ones that are so profitable since 9/11. I mean, we're seeing 300% increase in profits for Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, values of their stock that occurred, and you know, literally capturing billions of dollars of money, and because of war, and then having people right sitting on the boards of the big media companies.
It is a 2,000-pound bomb that is deadly accurate, and that is the thing that is allowed us in Afghanistan and will allow us in this next conflict to be terribly accurate, terribly precise, and terribly destructive.
To see that military targets are destroyed, to be sure, but that it's done in a way and in a manner and in a direction and with a weapon it is appropriate to that very particularized target. The weapons that are being used today have a degree of precision that no one ever dreamt of.
John Stauber from the Center for Media and Democracy.
Well, there's a saying, the first casualty of war is the truth, and that's true. You know, whether any country uses propaganda, first of all, on its own citizens, to get into a war and to make sure the public supports the war, and then on the enemy to defeat the enemy. And wars are filled with propaganda terms like friendly fire. I hate that term. I mean, what it means is we killed one of our own soldiers. Friendly fire sounds like, you know, let's get out the marshmallows and the s'mores. Or we now have bombs that are smart bombs, and so they don't cause collateral damage. What does that even mean, smart bombs and collateral damage? It means that when you're bombing Baghdad, you're killing civilians. There's no way around it. That's collateral damage. It sounds like something in an insurance policy. You know, it helps us not really think of what's going on. The idea of the military being able to show footage from a nose cone of some missile entering a window and blowing up a building, well, obviously that's a pretty smart bomb because it just went in there and got the bad guys. I mean, the bad guys is sort of a post 9/11 term that's right out of, you know, all the cowboy movies of the 20th century. The Lone Ranger was always after the bad guys. John Wayne was always out to get the bad guys.
Graham McQueen from the Center for Peace Studies.
We're often led to believe that this is another one of these binary systems, you know. In other words, we have a choice. Killing is either intentional or it's unintentional. And unintentional means somehow accidental. That's what we're often being told by our leaders. And that terrorists do the first. They kill intentionally. And when I say kill, I mean kill innocent people intentionally. Kill civilians and kids and stuff. And we, on the other hand, unfortunately sometimes, you know, do that, but it's always unintentional. It's accidental. It's not what we're really trying to do. And I think my response to that is twofold. In terms of intention, this is a false binary. And if you look at legal systems around the world, you find that they recognize that to talk about murder, for example, most legal systems will say you have to have more than A killing B, which is a physical act. You also have to have a certain mental state. In Latin, mens rea, and means the guilty mind. And then there are discussions and distinctions and divisions in legal systems as to what this guilty mind would involve. And it doesn't have to necessarily involve, you know, twirling your handlebar mustache and saying, I'm going to kill 500,000 kids in Iraq. But in our legal system, we recognize that there can be a guilty mind without that degree of intentionality. So there are concepts of criminal negligence. There are concepts of doing something knowingly rather than unknowingly. Concepts of recklessness. Concepts of so-and-so knew or should have known, should have reasonably known, that their action would cause this death. There are at least four levels of distinction in this idea of the guilty mind. And we should keep this in mind, because it isn't a question of either, on the one hand, twirling your handlebar mustache, or somehow it's an accident. There's all these possibilities in between. So, for example, if somebody says, well, my intention was not to kill anybody. I was hungry. There was a hot dog stand. I saw there was only one hot dog left. So I drove my Humvee there as quickly as I could. Yes, I ran over 18 people. Because there was a crowd in front of the hot dog stand, but my intention was not to kill people, it was to have a hot dog. Well, okay, try that one. You know, you'll end up in jail for quite a while. But the second thing I want to do is talk about actual military strategy. Some people still think that, the governments of the West would never do any kind of attack on civilians. Well, excuse me, that's very naive. Since at least Clausewitz, who was a theoretician of war in the early 1800s, this idea of, Clausewitz had this notion of what he called centers of gravity. It's not enough to attack the army of your opponent. You know, in a modern industrial society, it might make at times much more sense to attack, for example, their centers of production, industrial production, or their centers of production of information and propaganda, or whatever. He called these centers of gravity. And this idea of the COG, or center of gravity, is still very much alive in U.S. Air Force doctrine. And it's recognized that a society will have certain centers of gravity which must be attacked. You see this in the attacks on Iraq, let's say in 1991, where the hydroelectric stations were targeted. They obviously were vital to the health of the society. They were vital to maintaining pure water, for example, sewage system, water purification system. So when you talk about they only used precision-guided munitions, the question is, yeah, but if they used them to knock out those mechanisms for maintaining health in the society, then obviously they're destroying that health, and they know they are. And they even talk about targeting it at times. A study called Iraq Water Treatment Vulnerabilities was produced for the U.S. military and the U.K. military. It is dated sometime January 1991. So the sanctions had been going on for some months, since August, against Iraq, but the actual armed attack hadn't quite yet begun. And the study concludes that Iraq's water purification system is in deep trouble because of the sanctions. Iraq, the document says very clearly, will not be able to repair these systems as long as the sanctions that now exist are in place. And it says it's already in deep disrepair and it's going to get worse. And we can expect the following epidemic diseases to break out, and then they list them. We know they received the document, January 1991, so what did they do? Well, they attacked Iraq, and they made water purification and sewage treatment even worse, much worse, in fact, than it had been when the document was written. They destroyed some of these systems directly. In other cases, rendered them inoperative indirectly through knocking out hydroelectric stations. And then they maintained this system in a hopeless state of disrepair for the next 10 years or so. So a reasonable estimate is that 500,000 kids in Iraq that would otherwise be alive died during that period. Not all from diarrheal diseases, but a substantial number. And it was known, and the study had been done, and everything was in place. Now, so what do we do with that? Was there a group of military officers sitting around Washington, let's say, and saying, let's kill 500,000 Iraqi kids? Don't know. Probably not. But they were in full control of the situation, knew it was happening at every stage. So they did it knowingly. And they would certainly, if this had been a domestic crime, be considered to have mens rea, you know, the guilty mind, and certainly be considered responsible. And to top it all off, we have a publication in which a U.S. military officer brags about the fact that they created, I think he calls it, a public health crisis in Iraq through these sorts of methods. So not only did we do it, not only did we know we were doing it, but we celebrate it. We regard it as a legitimate way of fighting war, despite the fact that, of course, it's against the Fourth Geneva Convention. This is what's being done. This is the kind of thing that's being done pretty regularly now through high-tech modern warfare by so-called democracies. And the actual agent of destruction may be a precision-guided missile. It doesn't matter if the point of it is to ruin the health of a population, a civilian population.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
There's a quote from Milton's Paradise Lost. First Moloch, horrid king, besmeared with blood of human sacrifice and parents' tears. Though for the noise of drums and timbrels loud, their children's cries unheard that passed through fire to his grim idol.
Closely related to the practices of torture in total warfare is the concept of demonstrative violence. In the Philippines during the Hook insurrection, the CIA's Ed Lansdale would use brutal violence as a form of Psy War. A later U.S. Army Psy War pamphlet explicitly refers to Lansdale's techniques, advocating exemplary criminal violence, the murder and mutilation of captives, and the display of their bodies. In Indonesia, under various U.S.-backed dictatorships, the idea of demonstrative violence would again take on genocidal proportions. As a Psy War tactic, the bodies of men, women, and children were dumped in rivers and kept afloat as a warning to the population at large. To make sure they didn't sink, the carcasses were deliberately tied to or impaled on bamboo stakes. The rivers literally ran red with blood. Like psychological warfare itself, demonstrative violence is as old as civilization. One of the most brutal forms would also become the symbol of one of the world's great religions. Crucifixions were not only a means of torture and execution, but a demonstration to other would-be rebels